Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin and go to Beirut, Lebanon, for an update on the repercussions from the bombings at the Iranian embassy and speak with Thanasi Kambanis, who writes the internationalist column for the Boston Globe and is the author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. We'll discuss Lebanon's shaky stability and how much it is being sucked into the vortex of the brutal civil war next door in Syria. Then we'll go to Caracas, Venezuela, and speak with Virginia Lopez, who covers Latin America and Venezuela for the UK Guardian, where she has an article, Nicolas Maduro Promises to Use New Powers to Rescue Venezuela's Economy. We'll discuss the 12-month emergency decree granted to President Maduro ahead of the December 8 municipal elections to rescue the economy from what he calls bourgeois parasites and the economic warfare being waged by the ever-present Yankee imperialists. Then finally, we'll discuss the frenzied exaggerations in the media of the impending doom of Obamacare that has the New York Times comparing a faulty website to President Bush's failure to respond to Hurricane Katrina, in which 1,900 people died. Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, joins us to discuss his article at the Huffington Post, No One Died at Healthcare.gov, The Phony Crisis of Obamacare. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now from Beirut is Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambanis, who is a fellow at the Century Foundation. He writes the internationalist column for the Boston Globe and blogs at thanasiskambanis.com. He is the author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And his forthcoming book is about Egyptian revolutionaries after the fall of President Hosni Mubarak. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thanasi Kambanis.
Great to talk to you, Ian.
And the bombing on Monday in Beirut does seem to indicate that Lebanon is sort of slipping into the orbit of the Syrian civil war next door. Is there a sense that Lebanon is being sucked into that vortex?
I mean, look, the sense for quite some time has been that that we're sort of bobbing on the edge of this whirlpool, and the question is, will we be sucked in? Will the conflict engulf us? We've had, as in fact we've talked about on your show before, some previous attacks and bombings and assassinations here in Lebanon over the last year. This one's a little bit different, and the reason why it's made people a little more anxious than the previous ones is because it is a big deal to try and blow up an embassy. That's the sovereign territory of the country you're attacking, and everybody knows that Iran is a big player in this proxy war that's going on in Syria. Everybody here very clearly sees a cast of characters where Iran is leading the charge on one side and Saudi Arabia on the other. And all this is, it's not exactly theoretical, but it's at a distance. When two suicide bombers blow themselves up against the gates of the Iranian embassy in a part of Beirut that's heavily patrolled and controlled by Hezbollah, that's another thing. And that's a step that's bold enough and potentially destabilizing enough to really alarm people here.
Well, I suppose that Lebanon is already involved in this war, in as much as it's a country of only 4.5 million people, yet it's absorbed around 800,000 refugees from Syria, according to the United Nations. That's an extraordinary figure in itself compared to the population. It's almost a fifth of the population.
Right. I actually think the latest number is certainly more like one in four people inside Lebanon's borders are Syrian refugees. They're everywhere. And importantly, a lot of the people who are refugees here are either fighters on one side or another in the conflict, or were directly displaced by actions supported by someone inside Lebanon. So a lot of raw feelings, a lot of very intense anger. And the thing to really try and figure out here is, everybody who's anybody in Lebanon, politically and militarily, has a hand in the conflict in Syria, right? They're recruiting fighters and sending them over, or like Hezbollah, they're overtly involved as a quasi-state actor. So the question is, at what point do all these different players lose their interest in keeping the war over there and not over here. And that's, you know, that's something there's a lot of different opinions on, and it's also the kind of thing that it's really easy to miscalculate about when you're, you know, when you're dealing with so many different emotions and variables in life or death situations.
Again, I'm speaking with Lebanese-based journalist Tanasi Kambanis, who is a fellow at the Century Foundation. He writes the Internationalist column for the Boston Globe and blogs at thanasiskambanis.com. He is also the author of A Privilege to Die: Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And his forthcoming book is about Egyptian revolutionaries after the fall of President Hosni Mubarak. It does seem, though, on the humanitarian side, given the enormous tragedy in Syria, where over 100,000 people have died, one-third of the population has been displaced, 6 million people apparently, and the country's literally being torn apart and destroyed slowly but surely. And the world is not ponying up. The arms are pouring in from Iran, from Russia, from Qatar, from Saudi, and from the West. But they're very slow with the humanitarian aid. I believe Oxfam recently revealed how disgusting the Russians are. They've virtually given no money, and so is Qatar. The U.S. has given the most money, but even that is less than was promised. So do you see that as a sort of an obscenity here, that they're pouring arms in but being stingy about helping the poor victims of this war?
Well, look, I mean, it's morally horrifying, right? For essentially nickels on the dollar in terms of what we spend on military intervention and propping up different sides of the conflict, that we're not doing more for the displaced. Now, let's talk about the consequences of this humanitarian disaster, because I think these sort of numbers often dull people's minds, and it's hard for people to grasp what the cost of this is in human lives, and also what's new and different about this conflict. Polio, a disease that's been eradicated in our part of the world since the 70s and was almost eradicated worldwide, is making a comeback in Syria and in neighboring countries. My kids were vaccinated for polio at school, along with every school child in Lebanon last week. This is because polio strains, apparently from eastern Pakistan, brought by jihadis into the Syrian theater, have spread pretty majorly along through the refugee population. And this is a direct result of the breakdown of the government and of society by the conflict. Jihadis in Syria are prohibiting people from vaccinating kids. The war is displacing, as you said, a third of the population of an entire country. It doesn't take an epidemiologist to figure out how that can lead to an epidemic of a horrific disease that had been eliminated in this part of the world. And that's just the first really nasty consequence of our indifference to the conflict and of the breakdown of the humanitarian response. And I think it's really dispiriting.
So what is the, I mean, I know that one can really understand the minds of these jihadis, because they are so, what's the word? Radical doesn't begin to describe them.
Well, antediluvian, right? I was sitting with a Syrian doctor from Aleppo who's now here, and he was just in despair. He was saying, who are these people who want to prohibit my colleagues, my kids, from getting vaccinated against polio? And it really does beggar the imagination.
So, again, I'm speaking with Tanasi Kambanis, who is in Beirut, and we're talking about the bombing on Monday, which, of course, killed 23 people, including a senior Iranian cultural attaché, Sheikh Ibrahim Ansari. What I understand, though, in a surreal way, there was a football match, a soccer match, was it today or yesterday, where Iran was playing Lebanon, and there was nobody in the stands, yet I imagine people watched it on television. So how much has the country become numb to this violence? It had a civil war. There have been a series of bombings that we talked about earlier, and we've discussed as, you know, when they happened. And now you've had this attack on the Iranian embassy. I guess there's always been a surreal nature to civil war and to this, the sort of what's been referred to as the Paris of the Middle East. On the one hand, people driving around in sports cars with designer clothes, and a few blocks away, mayhem going on. Am I correct in suggesting there's something strange about this picture here?
Well, look, I mean, the people who especially were alive during the years of the Civil War, and even people who weren't, have gone through several cycles of war with Israel. It is not a normal place, right? I mean, people have a pretty high threshold for instability and violence if they're still here. You know, what goes on is a sort of two-level game. On one level, people try to game out how stable things are. So, in the like yesterday's attack happens, and everyone is discussing, hey, is this the first step in a slide to war, or is this just another notch in this sort of thing that's been going on, but that's gonna, the order is gonna hold. And so that's one level. On the other level, what goes on is that people, on a personal level, feel insecure, frightened, and nervous. You know, so even in the same conversation, people will sort of agree with my analysis that, that in fact all the powers that be want to maintain the status quo. And so, as alarming as this is, there's no reason to think it marks the beginning of a sort of, a cataclysmic fall into a renewed civil war. On the other hand, they'll say, I can't believe that even in this neighborhood we thought was safe, this thing happened. You know, my kids are scared, I'm scared. What kind of country is this? How can we, build businesses and plan a future in a place that has never really stabilized since 1975? And I think, the coexistence of those two levels of analysis show how abnormal the place is. And unfortunately, that kind of abnormality has become the normal, the new normal in the region. I mean, in Iraq, in Syria, Israel, Palestine, and here, it's been like that more often than it hasn't in the last four decades.
So this was a World Cup qualifying match, was it not, with Iran versus Lebanon? Why nobody in the stands? Is that, and that's not unusual, is it? It's not about security,
well,
is it?
You know, that kind of thing, the matches without stands happens here all the time, for both for political reasons and for just regular soccer hooliganism. So there's, I mean, every, you know what happens in regular countries in soccer matches and how likely violence is to break out between opposing fans. Here, there's almost always an extra political dimension to it. I mean, there's a basketball team in the professional league that's considered the Hezbollah team. There's a basketball team that's considered the Sunni team. When they play, there's always, risk of a riot that could turn worse. And so most of the time, when those teams match up, there's no fans in the stands either. So that's actually not so unusual here. But I think you're right. To an outsider, again, it shows how odd the daily life has become.
So, given the proximity of this war next door, and as we mentioned, you've got about a quarter of the population now are refugees from this war in Syria, and as you pointed out, many of them are combatants or families of combatants or people who've been displaced. So they bring with them a lot of anger and bitterness as well. So it makes it much more combustible. But in the war itself next door in Syria, it does look as if the Assad regime has made some significant gains, even though it's still a military stalemate. But what seems to be clear to me, at least, is that everybody's forgotten how this war started. They've forgotten that it's this obstinate mafia ruling family that decides that it has divine right to rule and will murder anybody that challenges them. And now it has spiraled into such a patchwork of fiefdoms in the north with all these crazy jihadis, the ones that don't want to have kids immunized against polio, that behead prisoners, and all of this brutal, unbelievably brutal stuff. And that seems to have changed the narrative. Is that what's happened now, people? And, of course, this plays into Assad's hands if everybody's focused on how hideous these Saudi and Qatari-backed rebels are. Somehow, is Assad getting a free pass?
Well, I think you're putting it exactly right by rewinding and telling the sort of nutshell narrative from the beginning. That is more or less what has happened. And it looks like Assad really could end up staying in power, not because people love him, but because he has pursued a very effective Machiavellian strategy, and crucially because people have grown in a large measure sick of the rebels. So that's a really sad outcome, because, as you said, this rebellion began not with antediluvian Salafi jihadists who wanted to turn back the clock 1300 years. It began with kids in Daraa who were asking for the regime to have accountability and stop torturing people, and who were nonviolent protesters, and who in response were tortured to death by the regime. Now, 3 years later, we have a situation where literally we have one set of jihadis beheading a jihadist from another faction because they mistook him for a Shia, and broadcasting it on YouTube. And that kind of action makes normal Syrians who don't like the regime think that the regime is maybe a better bet than these rebels. And that's a real tragic outcome, and it's one where we really could see essentially the quiescence of the population playing into the hands of the regime, because the regime is horrible, and the alternative might be far worse.
So, Thanasi Kambanis, has that also played to Hezbollah's advantage? Because initially, when Hezbollah intervened in the war and sent its legions into Syria, there was quite a negative response in the Arab world. But now, have they benefited from this shift away from support for the rebels to a kind of tacit acceptance of the Assads?
There's two things Hezbollah needs to come out on top. One is that they need an outright regime victory, and the other, which has now come true, is they needed the rebellion to be able to be portrayed as an anti-pluralistic, anti-human rights, sort of modern Middle East retrograde force, and they got that right. So a year ago, when Hassan Nasrallah talked about the Syrian rebellion as a force that could end the way of life for Lebanon, as Lebanese know and love it, as a force that would sort of erase the ability of Shia, Sunni, Christians, and others to coexist, it seemed an exaggeration, possibly a lie. Today, the evidence has come to pass for that claim, and now they're just waiting and hoping to achieve their other goal, which is not a punishing stalemate in Syria, but an outright victory for the regime, at which point Hezbollah will, if that comes to pass, will be able to feel vindicated in their all-in strategy.
So just in closing then, Thanasi Kambanis, do you have any sense of what the Saudi and Qatari endgame is here? I mean, it's pretty difficult to buy the Saudi excuses that, all that money that's pouring in is just from wealthy charitable donations from private Saudi citizens, and we, the government that has such a tight lid on this country, has its secret police and its religious police completely oppressing the people in that country. Somehow or other, they can't stop all this money flowing in. And we've discussed what kind of hideous repercussions this money has had. And these jihadis have come from all over the place, and from Pakistan, and where they brought their polio with them. So it's a terrible, terrible picture. And, you know, you ask yourself, does the Saudi royal family want Syria to end up as the Somalia on the Mediterranean? What in God's name is their end game?
And they quite clearly, I mean, number one, they want to stay in power. And number two, they want to turn back the tide that's been going in favor of Iran. So Iran won influence in Iraq. Now the Saudis want to take Syria out of their sphere of influence. And that's the strategic game they're fighting. But they don't have the tools. I mean, they've got cash that none of us can believe, the amount of cash they have at their disposal. They don't even have enough diplomats or spies to put on the ground to give weapons to their chosen warlords. They have to subcontract that out to other countries, Jordanians, Turks, others. They don't have the personnel. And the other thing they don't have is ideological coherence. I mean, these are repressive monarchies that have made pacts with the devil, with extremist Takfiri branches of Wahhabi Islam, and ultimately the ideologies they support want to overthrow the monarchies in the Gulf. So it's an incoherent marriage between the Takfiri jihadists and the Saudi ruling family, and you know, there have been clashes between those two strains before, and one day that is going to explode, and it's either going to end up with some kind of major challenge to their rule in the Gulf, or some kind of major sort of conflict in which those forces are wiped out in the Gulf, and that is going to be an ugly fight, and it's going to have a lot of repercussions on the oil market as well as on the politics of the region.
Well, Thanasi Kambalis, I thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
All right. Take care, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Lebanese-based journalist Thanasi Kambalis, who is a fellow at the Century Foundation. He writes the internationalist column for the Boston Globe and blogs at thanasikambalis.com. He is also the author of A Privilege to Die, Inside Hezbollah's Legions and Their Endless War Against Israel. And his forthcoming book is about Egyptian revolutionaries after the fall of President Hosni Mubarak. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back and go to Venezuela to talk about President Nicolas Maduro's emergency power decree to rescue the economy.
Otra la sana, caballo viejo se encuentra, el pecho se le desgrana y no le hace caso a falseta, y no le obedece a freno ni lo paran falsas riendas.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Virginia Lopez, a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom and Sky TV. She has an article in Wednesday's Guardian, Nicolas Maduro Promises to Use New Powers to Rescue Venezuelan Economy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Virginia Lopez.
Hi, Ian. How are you?
So I'm fine. It sounds like your country is in chaos here. You've got essentially an emergency decree. I know that Hugo Chavez did have, I think, four times he had suspended the parliament, if you will, and ruled by emergency decree. In this case, his successor, Maduro, has managed to get the parliament to relinquish its authority and give him the emergency powers to rule for, 12 months to yes. turn the economy around?
Yes, that's one of the reasons he's asked for it. He's also claimed he needs these to fight corruption. And only recently, or the latest thing he said yesterday, was to also establish the internal order. We're still trying to figure out what that one means.
Well, is there internal disorder? I know we've talked about, you've done some coverage of the state of the prison population and how dangerous it is. And also, you've talked a lot in the past about the street crime. I think it's got one of the highest crime rates in, certainly in the Americas, Venezuela. The president, Maduro, of course, continually talks about outside forces destabilizing the place, along with local, he refers to them, the shopkeepers, as bourgeois parasites. His language is getting pretty interesting, wouldn't you say?
Yes, and you have to remember that this is coming ahead of municipal elections at a time when Maduro had lost a lot of the popularity after the elections of April. Once again, he also won with a razor thin margin. A lot of the analysts I've spoken to think that both the enabling law and also a lot of these sort of economic measures that are quite reminiscent to Chavez are more political really than economic. So, you know, it's sort of a way of gaining support. It seems that he has actually succeeded in gaining support after businesses were asked to slash their prices. So it's, like I said, it seems that he's imitating a lot of Chavez's style, not only in the rhetoric, but also in asking the Congress for these special powers.
Well, I imagine it would make anybody popular if you basically told shoppers you could go into these shops and get what was originally, you know, priced at, say, $100. You can get the same item for, what, $25? What have these decrees done in terms of reducing prices? Apparently, Maduro said they are barbaric, these capitalist parasites. Let nothing be left on the shelves. So it sounds like, you know, what they call Black Friday here, these sales that they have after Thanksgiving where people trample over each other to get inside for the bargains. Is that what happened?
There were cases of looting in different cities across the country. But for the most part, because this was done with the National Guard, people were kept in order. From what I could see here in Caracas, the National Guard, you know, heavily armed, was giving people numbers so that they would queue up quite orderly outside the stores and then be called in small groups of, say, 10 people at a time. And then once inside, you were only allowed to buy a maximum of 3 products. But yes, of course, it's an increasingly popular measure among some to be able to, you know, afford, household appliances that had, you know, otherwise they probably would have never been able to afford. The other half of the population, I think, is quite indignant and certainly quite scared of what this means for the commercial sector. Venezuela relies heavily on imports, and I think very few people can imagine that businessmen are too encouraged to continue importing after these measures, no? So I think, you know, for the most part, it's been framed sort of like this is a big party, and then the hangover will probably come, you know, in January and February. As it is, Venezuela is already facing severe shortages of basic goods. You know, it's not uncommon to see people queuing up outside grocery stores to buy, you know, the allotted 2 kilos of sugar or the allotted 4 rolls of toilet paper. So, you know, it's probably bound to get worse, although Maduro has assured it won't, but, you know, who knows?
Well, I guess with the media now being entirely under the control of the government, there's no commercial media left, I understand, that supports the opposition, with Globo Television now being bought by some cronies of Chavez's and Maduro's. Do the merchants have any voice? I mean, you know, one is not normally that sympathetic to merchants, but on the other hand, they have to make a living. And if are they selling all of these products at a loss? Is that what's happening?
There has been a lot of speculation. There's been a foreign exchange control in Venezuela for the last 10 years. So, you know, a lot of people got a foreign currency approved by the government and sold, and these dollars were sold at 6 bolivars to a dollar. But again, a lot of people didn't get this money approved, and so they had to rely on the black market, which clearly is illegal, and also, you know, right now as we speak, it's 10 times the official rate. So you know, the overpricing is relative. I think probably in some cases, you know, where people were getting preferential dollars from the government, they were clearly overpricing, and then in other cases, you know, merchants were having to rely on the black market to continue on their imports. No,
I see.
But like you said, you know, because the media is controlled by the government right now, the stories you hear are only sort of one sided. It's quite difficult to get a clear sense of exactly what's happening. No, but the truth is that regardless of whether they were getting preferential dollars and overpricing or not, after you see your stores being, you know, looted or in the best cases, you know, intervened by the National Guard, I think it's pretty discouraging to want to, you know, rebuild your business in the next following months. I spoke to somebody who described the way that her family's car dealership was intervened, and the whole thing sounded really intimidating. You know, this was something where the National Guard was going in, the intelligence police were going in, even like a small commission from, you know, the presidency was going in. So it seems to me that there was quite a bit of intimidation involved in the way that this was carried out.
Again, I'm speaking with Virginia Lopez, who is in Caracas, Venezuela, where she covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom and Sky TV. She has an article in Wednesday's Guardian, Nicolas Maduro promises to use new powers to rescue Venezuelan economy. So he's got the new powers. He's argued that Venezuela has been a victim of economic warfare. The country has, what is it now, 54%? It's the annual inflation is 54%, and the oil sector, I understand, is all but paralyzed in terms of revenues. There's no way that they can increase any revenues, my understanding is. They've also taken out some substantial loans from the Chinese. Is anybody trying to ruin the Venezuelan economy, or is it just being mismanaged by this very same government that's now got emergency decrees to fix it?
After 10 years of foreign currency of currency control, it's I think hard to believe that this is internal sabotage. Economic warfare being waged by the opposition. I think it's also quite obvious that the people behind the state agency that were approving these preferential dollars were government officials. And so if anything, you can argue that these people weren't doing their job right. The corruption cases in Caribe, which is the name of the state agency approving the preferential dollars, are, you know, ridiculous. It's actually something that Maduro has even admitted to. Not necessarily specifying where to lay the blame, but I think one of the most sort of emblematic cases of how widespread this corruption was is a motor racer, speed racer athlete who got $60 million at the preferential rate, apparently to support his sporting activities. You know, well, clearly $60 million is a lot of money for a speed racer, I would think. He's now gone to jail, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. We're talking about, you know, as in any oil economy, vast contracts with, you know, of many, many million dollars that where there's no transparency and where there's very little accountability.
So I've heard that in many ways this is a form of crony capitalism with a socialist sort of patina. Is that what's going on here, that friends of the regime, because a lot of businesses have been expropriated and nationalized over the last 10 years in any case. Is this what's going on, that you basically have a system of preferential treatment for people who are connected to the regime and the rest is, you know, have got to fend for themselves?
I would say some of that is correct. It's difficult to substantiate because, you know, the information doesn't necessarily flow freely. Figures are not released, freely. But the one case that makes this quite, or exemplifies this quite well also is, I think it was early this week, the high-ranking official at the Venezuela Development Bank that finally pleaded guilty to charges of bribery and basically using her post to misdirect funds at the order, I believe, of $40 million or so. I don't have the exact figure. But this is a case of corruption that we only found out because it was taking place in the U.S. She pleaded guilty to the U.S. authorities, not to Venezuelan. And there had been no mention of this until, you know, it became public in the U.S. So definitely no sense of accountability or checks and balances. Yes, I think a lot of nepotism going on, and certainly, you know, the emergence of a new elite in the last 14 years, which might point out the cronyism.
So with this economy, it looks as if it's in free fall with 54% inflation, and the oil sector, which is the the main source of income, the state oil company. Apparently, it's financially hobbled and unable to generate the kind of money that the country will need to get over the hump. So if Maduro has pulled off this stunt of allowing people to go in and get goods and, you know, plasma TVs and washing machines at a fraction of what they were being charged before, that's made him popular in the short run ahead of the December 8th municipal elections. Is there any chance that there'll be a backlash, that he won't? At this point, I guess analysts are saying that he's pulled it off. I mean, he may well be the reason why the economy's in shambles, but at this point, he's able to sort of blame it on others and get a new lease on life. Is that what's happened?
It could be that, you know, come 2014, we face severe shortages and people, you know, and there's an increasing sense of unrest. But it can also be that we're facing a scenario similar to Zimbabwe, where, you know, analysts were predicting in 2007 that it was definitely the end of Mugabe after he actually did basically a carbon copy, or actually Maduro did a carbon copy of what Mugabe did back then. And what is it, 2013, and we still have Mugabe, just recently won presidential election. So, you know, it's hard to understand and even more so to predict.
But the opposition, with no access to the media, what's the prognosis for these municipal elections on December the 8th?
Before these economic measures, they seemed to be garnering more support. Before these economic measures. Now I get the sense from analysts that I've spoken to that Maduro might have gained support, you know, in his basis. I think abstention is going to play an important role. I also think that the big urban centers might not be won by Maduro. So, you know, it'll probably continue dividing society.
So the prognosis is that you may end up, if you're using Mugabe as the analogy, that's pretty grim. I mean, he did win the elections, but they were completely rigged. And the place is devastated economically. But him and his cronies are riding high and living off the fat of the land. So is that the picture you're painting for the future of Venezuela?
Not necessarily. I don't think we're at that point. It would take oil prices to plummet probably to launch us into that, you know, that grim of a scenario. But what I meant to say was that people were predicting it was Mugabe's end back in 2007 after similar measures, and he's still there. So it's hard to know what's going to happen here. I don't think necessarily this is the end of Maduro because of the backlash in 2014. I don't even know that there's going to be a backlash. Because again, you know, with oil at 100 plus a barrel, or close to that, it might be that Maduro still has quite a bit to finance, you know, his government with. It's unpredictable.
How often can Maduro cry wolf over the Yankee imperialists? Because I'm not sure that the United States cares much anymore about Venezuela. And the evidence so far of all of these so-called spies and kicking out embassy officials, it all seems very theatrical, and there's never any substance at the end of the day. So is that still playing, that sort of nationalist card that the American imperialists are trying to – is that the subtext for this economic warfare that Maduro keeps talking about?
No. I think that clearly wasn't giving him any votes, so he had to push it a bit further and start this sort of, you know, Black Friday type handout of electrodomestics. It's a very sort of populist measure.
I see.
And it does feel like it's a piñata, you know, where goods are being handed out, and thus the host is liked. And in the same manner, I think it's probably quite short-lived. So you know, I don't know whether there's going to be a backlash of shortages that are going to plummet Maduro's popularity. I don't know if you know, people are going to take advantage of the household goods, but still punish Maduro at the polls because, you know, they've had relatives murdered with the incredible crime rate that we live with, it's difficult. I think, you know, there's a sort of initial effervescence and excitement at having gotten, you know, a plasma TV at a reduced price. But I think, you know, the reality is that you do have to go back home and you do have to go and get sugar and milk and toilet paper. And these things haven't been regularly stocked in market shelves here for, you know, close to 8 months. So, you know, so there's also that. And also, you know, and this has been said probably to the point of being tiresome, Maduro lacks Chavez's charisma. So there's a lot of things that Chavez could get away with. And Maduro just can't. He can't get away with crying wolf, I don't think. And like you say, even if he was charismatic, it's been 14 years of these claims that never go anywhere. So that's certainly grown tired here in Venezuela.
Well, Virginia Lopez, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Virginia Lopez, who's a Caracas-based journalist who covers Latin America and Venezuela for The Guardian of the United Kingdom and Sky TV. She has an article in Wednesday's Guardian, Nicolas Maduro Promises to Use New Powers to Rescue Venezuelan Economy. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the phony crisis over Obamacare. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Profits, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and his latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, No One Died at Healthcare.gov, The Phony Crisis of Obamacare. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Baker.
Thanks a lot for having me on, Ian.
And it does seem that given the toll that this botched launch of healthcare.gov has taken on the president and on his signature achievement, the Affordable Care Act, so-called Obamacare, the latest polls indicate that he's at an all-time low in the polls. And we keep seeing pictures of this morose-looking, wounded president. So you're suggesting here that his demise is being exaggerated and this is something of a phony crisis?
Well, exactly. It really, you know, I've been trying to say with this is, you know, we should keep our eyes on the ball here. What's happened to date is people have been trying to get on the website and sign up for the insurance. And, you know, I haven't been trying to sign up for insurance, but I've had the experience of trying to do things on a website and be frustrated with it. It's not a lot of fun. But that's not exactly a disaster. And, you know, point is we want people to be able to continue with their insurance. They have to be able to sign up by December 15th to be eligible for January 1st. We still have a ways to go. You could get on other ways. So at this point, we don't even know there's been a single person that has been unable to get insurance because of this. So people have been frustrated on the website. That shouldn't have happened. That was clearly a big blunder. But this isn't quite a catastrophe. You know, I made the reference, No One Died at Healthcare.gov. New York Times had a big front page headline comparing this to Katrina, where people, of course, 1,900 people did die. So this has really been blown out of proportion hugely.
So what was, do you think, behind that New York Times article that featured Lori Gottlieb, a 46-year-old psychotherapist living here in Los Angeles?
Well, just to be clear, that actually was separate. That was a column. Laurie Gottlieb wrote a column in the Times complaining that she was losing her insurance policy. So, again, this is a separate issue, which, again, has been blown up, that we have people losing insurance policies. And this has, again, been made into this big thing. President Obama said you could keep your insurance, and yet there are many people around the country with individual insurance policies that are finding that they're canceled. And here, you know, there's a couple things going on. First, can you keep your insurance? Well, the vast, vast majority of people who were insured as of 2010 can keep their insurance, either because it was a grandfathered plan, individual plan. Not that many in that boat, as people pointed out, but some people are. The individual plans that were in existence as of 2010 could stay in existence regardless of whether they meet the conditions. And secondly, most people have insurance, have it through their employer. And again, there are very few employers could decide anything they want, but they're not doing that because of the ACA. So the vast majority of people who had insurance in place as of 2010 can keep their plans. What's been the big issue is insurers were offering plans 2011, 2012, and even in the current year that they know didn't comply with the rules of the ACA, so that they no longer would be able to offer them after December 31st of this year. So those people are being told by their insurers now that, oh, guess what, January 1st, you'll have to get new insurance. And that's, you know, okay, you know, that's really unfortunate, but the reality is if an insurer was offering a plan to someone in July, in May of this year, you know, which most of these plans are fairly new, and they didn't tell them, I have a little hard time seeing that as a horrible sin on Obama's part. Again, it would have been great had Obama been clear, you know, this is only applying to, you know, the plans that were in effect as of 2010. But where you had insurers offering plans that they knew they'd have to cancel after January 1st, and they didn't tell the people that were buying them, that doesn't look to me like President Obama's fault.
So do you think that it's obvious that the Republicans smell blood in the water and they're absolutely gleeful and the Democrats are scared to death, but are the insurance companies also smelling blood in the water and doing what they can to undermine it? What I find extraordinary about this whole situation is that nobody, as everybody piles on about this healthcare.gov crash and the glitches and how the sky is falling, nobody is mentioning that if you go back to the status quo ante, to this broken healthcare system, you couldn't be worse off. I mean, who can defend the status quo ante? I mean, even if this thing hasn't got up and running yet, at least it's going to be an improvement on what we had. But now it seems that the propaganda is so intense here that this is a catastrophe that, you know, people are basically wanting to get their old policies back as if they were any damn good to begin with.
Well, again, this is why I was writing the piece, is that I think this is something that's been blown out of proportion. Obviously, the opponents of the Affordable Care Act, Republicans mostly, they see this as something to make a big deal. And this is, you know, the Republicans have done this. You know, Democrats do this too, so I'm not going to say Republicans are the only ones that make big issues out of things that may not be big issues. But clearly they've done this, and I guess I blame the media for picking up on that, like, yes, the Republicans are yelling, you know, the sky is falling because of what President Obama is doing. They've always done that. And, you know, that when you have reporters that hear the Republicans jumping up and down yelling and screaming, they should approach the issue with, yes, Republicans are jumping up and down yelling and screaming because that's what they do, rather than running front page articles about this is Hurricane Katrina. So that's really where I see the problem lying. And, yeah, you're exactly right. You know, are we going to go back to the old system? What's the plan here? And, you know, again, my line here is that, you know, you keep your eye on the ball, people will be able to sign up for insurance. In fact, as I understand it, the exchanges are working much better now. And, of course, many states, California being one of them, has their own exchange that, as I understand, works quite well. So people are signing up for insurance. And I have to imagine that this is going to be a huge, huge deal. I mean, I think of my own situation. My wife has a chronic condition. And, you know, if we were to, my employment situation were to change, we'd pay a fortune for insurance in the private market. And, you know, there's a lot of people in that situation. And knowing that, you know, if something happened, you quit your job, you lose your job, you could just go on an exchange and get an insurance package that, you know, for the most part, you know, I've had arguments being affordable. What's affordable? We could argue about that, but the point is, if you have a pre-existing condition, you will be able to get insurance for a hell of a lot cheaper through the exchange than would be the case with the current system.
And again, I'm speaking with Dean Baker, the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank in Washington, D.C. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Profits, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and his latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. And he also has an article at the Huffington Post, No One Died at Healthcare.gov, The Phony Crisis of Obamacare. So we have clearly at the moment the wind is not at the president's back. I imagine, though, and a lot of people have predicted that this will actually get up and running relatively soon, and eventually this crisis will be over. Do you think that there will be any lessons learned here on the part of the Democrats, who are certainly not stepping up in defense of the president and his efforts to reform this broken healthcare system that costs us 18% of the GDP, which is about twice as what it costs other advanced democracies and industrial countries? You know, obviously we could talk about it should have been Medicare, it should have been expanded Medicare for all, it should have been single payer, it should have been the system that the rest of the world have, should have had a public option, all of those should-haves. But do you think anybody's going to say, you know, wait a minute, maybe we drank the Kool-Aid of the free market here with this, after all, was an invention of the Heritage Foundation, and it was first employed by Mitt Romney in Massachusetts. So all of those Democrats who seem to have drunk the Kool-Aid over that the free market cures all, do you think they're having a hangover?
Well, I think no one could be happy with what this thing looks like, and clearly it's more complex than need be, in the sense that if, you know, anyone were designing a system from scratch, no one in their right mind would come up with anything like this. So in that sense, you know, one hopes they've learned. But, you know, in my view, the idea we're going to have the ACA and then we're done with health care reform, no. I mean, we're going to have a lot of things that have to be fixed. We still have a lot of people that aren't going to be covered. Certainly the immigrant population's not covered, but many others, you know, aren't going to be covered. And we have to do more to get our costs under control. But it seems to me the main thing is get the thing in place, see where you can make changes. One of the obvious, you know, people have made the points that in a number of markets you just have one or two insurers there. Well, that seems to just beg for more competition. So that seems a great opportunity. How about a public option there? Let Medicare serve these markets, because the private sector voted with its feet that it doesn't want to. So, you know, let's see about getting Medicare in there. I mean, these are things we have to do. We're still paying way too much for our doctors. Our doctors get about twice what doctors get in Canada and West Europe, wherever you want to look. We pay too much for our drugs. I mean, there's all these issues that we have to deal with to get our costs more in line with the rest of the world. But, you know, to my view, first thing is, you know, let's get this in place, see what works, see what doesn't, and, you know, get back to then fixing it. But, you know, first thing, get this in place, get people covered, and then, you know, work from that point forward.
But it does seem that most of this is psychological as opposed to factual. And I suppose in many ways, this has always been a to get over a psychological hump, because there's been so much hostility to the idea of healthcare reform in the build-up to the launch of this. And, you know, that's clearly that political environment made single payer, you know, was so inhospitable that single payer wasn't really considered. So is this what's going on here, that because of the uncertainty that this launch, this botched launch of healthcare.gov, has just played right into the uncertainty, and that this is really a psychological situation as opposed to a real disaster?
Well, absolutely played into that, because, again, remember what the Republicans have been saying. They've been, you know, we had death panels. You know, they've been calling this socialism. They've been calling it slavery. I mean, really, I'm not making that up. I mean, you could find no shortage of Republican politicians. I mean, members of Congress. These are ostensibly respected people in the Republican Party who are saying these things. So they created this real doomsday scenario. We're a job killer. We're going to lose millions of jobs. We had people saying we were already losing jobs because of Obamacare. This was even in, you know, 2010, 2011, before almost anything about the bill took effect. So they've been building up fears about Obamacare ever since it was passed, or really even before it was passed. And now they finally have something concrete. And, you know, again, it's a horrible blunder. It's, you know, amazing how ill-prepared they were for the rollout date. You know, you have at least thought they would have known, if it wasn't ready for prime time, that they would have been able to say, okay, it's not ready, we're going to, if you don't delay the opening, try and discourage people so you don't overload the site. I mean, you know, I don't know exactly what would have been the best thing to do, but surely they should have known October 1st that they didn't have a website that was ready for prime time, and they don't seem to have been aware of that fact. Huge, huge blunder. But again, the reality that, you know, I think we have to just keep coming back to is we had people annoyed that they had to waste time on a website, which everyone can understand. That's a real annoyance. But, and no doubt some people are fearful that they aren't going to have insurance. But as of this date, now one person actually has gone uninsured because of this botched website rollout. So, yeah, it's totally a psychological story.
So just in the last minute then, apart from yourself, who is making this point? I mean, it feels like the momentum is all against the president here, and he's not exactly standing up. He keeps apologizing. Maybe he should be, you know, listening to what you're saying.
I wish they would. I mean, you know, again, the story with the insurers, you know, I feel bad if someone signed up for insurance in June and is finding out it's being canceled. But, you know, again, if an insurer offered the policy in June, they knew what the requirements of the law were, and they didn't tell someone. Again, if I'm President Obama, I'd say, I feel bad you're being burned, but, you know, your complaint is with the insurer. So, yeah, you know, I would love to see President Obama, see the Democrats in Congress stand up and say, look, you know, there's things to complain about the bill, but for the most part, that's not what we're talking about here.
Well, Dean Baker, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks a lot for having me on.
Again, I've been speaking with Dean Baker, who's the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank in Washington, D.C. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Profits, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press, and his latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. And his latest article at the Huffington Post is No One Died at Healthcare.gov, The Phony Crisis of Obamacare. This is Beam Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another background briefing. Bye for now. Bye.